My name is Paul Olson. I teach at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. I've taught English there for, I think, right after the Civil War. And I was also, strangely enough, the track coach there, too. It takes a weird, wonderful college to allow a professor in an academic area to also coach, but they did. That's enough introduction. These are the poems that you have that we're going to look at. And I picked these because they all deal with profound change in our culture, in our whole sense of history and being a part of this, it's as big as this planet. So I'll ask you, you can give me some examples of those, and I'll get you started. For example, how did a lot of people in this personal level deal with, we're talking a century long, and more really, the Industrial Revolution. So big movements like that. I'm going to record them so that we get a sense of how these poets look at their human experience and share it with us. I'll tell you how important I think this is, because I agree with Maya Angelou, who said, "We survive in the exact relationship to the dedication of our poets." They share the truth of the human experience, the complexity of it all. And so that they're not just about, they are about having pleasure reading a poem. We like the rhythm, we like the sound, we like the language. We also like the vision they have of the human experience. So, I'll write one down. It's the Industrial Revolution. I'm glad I got a whiteboard back. Holden Village took it away from me, punished me, fined me, because I wrote the wrong kind of magic marker on there. And I went to erase it, and I said, oops. the Industrial Revolution. Other really big movements.
The Great Depression.
The Depression.
War.
Electronic technology.
Bingo! I'm still suffering from that today.
Common schools.
Pardon me?
Common schools.
Common. Do you mean
everybody going to school?
Huh?
Universal education.
Okay. Common.
Common school is what they called it in the beginning.
Yeah. Common schools. Integrated schools. Okay, let's get personal. Most of you have been at Bible study. How about this? You grew up thinking that's part. I knew kind of what my audience would be, and I thought, yeah, we're changing. We have another life change within this, is that's going from professional to retired. How do we dance that? Navigate that route? But here we are all of a sudden, you mean there's a fifth gospel? No, there's 6, 7, 8, 9 gospels. What the heck? So we've got this, how about Darwinism? I'm going to put it down because it's a big deal. All of a sudden, that's what the Scopes trials were all about in 1925. How do you read the Bible? You take it literally, and the returnees would say, in trying to put Scopes on trial, we can get into that in a moment. Well, if you read the Bible not literally, then everything's a lie. And kids pick out poetry. So these poets, we're going to see it, have to deal with what happened when all of a sudden Adam and Eve, that's not the story, and this evolution stuff. And that's a big movement, is my point. Anything else?
I like the
yes.
Nuclear age.
Bingo. For sure, for us, that, you know, all history changes. But even in ancient days, they had different ways of thinking that the world might come to an end. Well,
climate
we've got
change.
These industrial, these big, big movements. And so the poems I selected are about how do we deal with those? What's our vision of humanity, of culture? What do we make of loving the other? You'll see all these kind of movements in this. Somebody asked me at lunch, year one, is this poetry going to be accessible? Or is it stuff you have to, you know, read over 12 times and think about? And I've always thought there's poetry on stage that you can get just like that, and there's poetry on the page, which is complicated. But some poems are really pretty easy to hear. And here's my lovely daughter-in-law here's the happy bounding flea. You cannot tell the he from she. But she can tell and he can tell. Or that one, the primal termite knocked on wood, tasted it and found it good. And that is why your cousin May fell through her parlor floor today. So poetry is accessible. And my own personal guideline for poetry, I guess for literature, and maybe for love, is this. It's the poem that's the front piece of every Robert Frost anthology. And it's this. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I think that's poetry. I think that's literature. What use is it? He didn't, but it's the one thing he wants to share. He doesn't need help reconciling his credit card. He doesn't need help buying a secondhand car. He doesn't need help fixing the porch. Because he'll do it, he'll figure it out. But this, I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. There's leaves on the pond, on the spring, and I'll only stop to rake the leaves away, like they need that. And then we'll wait to watch the water clear, man. You roughed it up a little bit, and the dust and all has the dirt left to settle. And then this miracle of birth. I'm going out to fetch the little calf, which would be fine out there in the field. We know calves have been born in the field. I'm going out to fetch the little calf. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with it. Just born. It can't even walk. You come too. So is poetry about use? Is it practical? My opinion is, you bet. We survive in the exact relationship to the dedication of our poets, because we see something else, and you'll see it in a minute. But then there's that other, that this is this thing about beauty. And we don't just live by the practical alone. So, these are the poems we'll go through, and they really are about how do we look at these big changes that are in our life? So, our very first one is the Maya Angelou one, A Brave and Startling Truth. And everybody have some of these down. Let's get those. Those aren't ours. There's four right here. One, two, three. Oh, and I'm going to read them so you'll be okay.
Yes. Is this the one?
By somebody that does, if you can, that'll work. And if you want it, if you have the wind in, you'll see, you want to keep it, we'll make sure we want it.
I can share
on
with
the back
Sue.
Side.
Just, I'll get it back for you. It's just written
down. You're all smart adults, and I'm not going to tell you what poems mean. We're just going to let them work on our hearts. I tell students, all literary criticism begins in the guts, and not your head. It'll go to your head because we are whole, W-H-O-L-E, people. How do you look at change? And how can you imagine another world? Another guideline for me for all literature is James Baldwin's great line in The Fire Next Time, and says, for centuries, the Negro has been America's fixed star. But when he moves, all heaven and earth shake. When he gets off, stops going to the back of the bus, asks to play quarterback, not tackle, asks to be a coach, not a manager, asks to be the principal, not the janitor, all heaven and earth shake. I think, I know it, I feel it in the room at Bible study. We hear these, ooh, here's a different Lord's Prayer Sunday night, right? Ooh. Okay, heaven and earth shake. Well, if you like to read poetry, I'll just throw this out to you. Follow the punctuation, don't, because it, rather than we go line by line and it stutters, and we'll get a sense of a different kind of truth if we. We, this people on a small and lonely planet traveling through casual space, past aloof stars, across the way of indifferent suns to a destination where all signs tell us it is possible and imperative that we learn a brave and startling truth. And when we come to it, to the day of peacemaking, when we release our fingers from fists of hostility and allow the pure air to cool our palms, when we come to it, when the curtain falls and the minstrel show of hate and faces sooted with scorn are scrubbed clean, when battlefields and Colosseum no longer rake our unique and particular sons and daughters up with the bruised and bloody grass to lie in identical plots in foreign soil, when the rapacious storming of the churches, the screaming racket in the temples have ceased, when the pennants are waving gaily, when the banners of the world tremble stoutly in the good, clean breeze, when we come to it, when we let the rifles fall from our shoulders and children dress their dolls in flags of truce, when landmines of death have been removed and the aged can walk into evenings of peace, when religious ritual is not perfumed by the incense of burning flesh and childhood dreams are not kicked awake by nightmares of abuse. When we come to it, there we will confess that not the pyramids with their stones set in mysterious perfection, nor the gardens of Babylon hanging as eternal beauty in our collective memory, not the Grand Canyon kindled into delicious color by western sunsets, nor the Danube flowing its blue soul into Europe, not the sacred peak of Mount Fuji stretching to the rising sun, neither Father Amazon nor Mother Mississippi, who, without favor, nurture all creatures in the depths and on the shores. These are not the only wonders of the world. When we come to it, we, this people, on this minuscule and kithless globe, who reach daily for the bomb, the blade, and the dagger, yet who petition in the dark for tokens of peace, we, this people on this mote of matter, in whose mouths abide cankerous words which challenge our very existence, yet out of those same mouths come songs of such exquisite sweetness that the heart falters in its labor and the body is quieted into awe. We, this people, on this small and drifting planet whose hands can strike with such abandon that in a twinkling life is sapped from the living, yet those same hands can touch with such healing, irresistible tenderness that the haughty neck is happy to bow and the proud back is glad to bend out of such chaos, of such contradiction. We learn that we are neither devils nor divines. When we come to it, we, this people, on this wayward floating body created on this earth, of this earth, have the power to fashion for this earth a climate where every man and every woman can live freely without sanctimonious piety, without crippling fear. When we come to it, we must confess that we are the possible, we are the miraculous, the true wonder of this world. That is when and only when we come to it. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And what we got a lot of things to be talking about. We got a lot of things to get through, too. But if we're talking about how to deal with change, what do you sense that this is what we have to do?
Just that there's hope.
Bingo. And how many of us listen to the news and finally just turn it off because it strikes too hard at our hope? Just stop the news. Give me some music. Stop the news. Let me play with my grandkids. Stop the news. Let me go for a bike ride. Hope. How about imagination? Can we imagine a world where, I can remember asking the question on 9/11, everybody said, we got to do this, we got to do this, I got to do this, and have we ever asked, why did this happen? We can meet in the church and light our candles, and we can go to war. And the question was, around us, what I heard, just with common people looking at this and their anger and their, and not frustration, that's too small a word, their anger and their hate, they killed us and they killed 2,000 of us, they attacked us, they burned our buildings. We got to get them. And the question wasn't whether we go to war or not, the question was, how do we go to war? And the fundamental question is not even asked. It's slavery days with whites enslaving black people in America. We shouldn't sell the families. We shouldn't make them work from sunup to sundown. We should provide food and clothing. A lot of them didn't. We should provide housing without asking the fundamental question, should we have slavery? So she addresses that, doesn't she? With all these, can we have a world that's about peace and not the daggers? Can we? And you have it. Well, we'll keep going. It's hard, I think, to change. All heaven and earth shake. The next one on there is the mending wall. I'll tell you the story of this, and so you can image this. You will, the poet doesn't need me. Here are two guys living across on either side of a fence made out of stone. You can think of New England or England, Scotland, Ireland, any the British Isles. We've got these stones, and every spring, one of the guys says to the other, it's springtime, we need to fix the holes, the gaps. The rocks, some rocks have fallen, and they give some reasons for that. Or maybe it's, you know, somebody moved the rock because there was a rabbit in there, and they moved the rock so the dog could get at it. Maybe it's the frost. And then when they don't know, well, maybe it's elves. Well, we'll get it. But what it's about is that we've got this institutional structure in their minds. We do this. We do this in the spring. We don't even know why we do it. And we work hard. We work to the point that our hands ache and they're gnarled and scraped. And we still do this. Well, here we go. Something that Robert Frost read this, by the way, on the Berlin Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I've come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and here's the iambic pentameter, and I'll never talk like an English teacher again, because who cares? But even the rhythm of the poem says, we just do this. So it is. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each the boulders that have fallen to each. And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with the handling of them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is a mischief in me. And I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built the wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in and walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to it, but it's not elves exactly. And I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, and not of woods only in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors. Change, structure, this exercise institution. So you tell me, how committed to this are they? Watch this image. They're nearly balls. We put them up, they're so nearly balls, and then say, stay where you are until the backs are turned. They don't even care if they stay. But we got to do this. Anything else?
It's hard not to think of Mexico-U.S. border in the current.
Wow, thank you. There we go. And the poet has a different vision of a wall. I'd like to know what I was walling in and walling out with the whom I was like to give offense.
When he talks about the cows, there apparently are some purposes for walls, though.
Yes.
So they have their different perspectives.
Sometimes, but not here. And right. We still do it. Good.
Yeah, I was thinking about what he was saying, and it's like they need this wall because that establishes it is the negotiation of their relationship. Think about what would happen if the wall were not there. They would have to continually negotiate their relationship because they would be in the same place at the same time, right?
Sure.
I would be over there, he would be over here. We'd have to negotiate how we're going to be with each other, whereas when you got a wall, there's no negotiation needed. It's quite clear.
It's part of their friendship?
Yeah.
Too?
Yeah.
But I love your phrase, negotiate the friendship. Who's most against it? The poet?
Yes.
Would you say?
Yeah.
Who starts
the conversation, right?
Who starts this?
Yeah.
He does.
He does. I wish he could figure this out by himself, but in the meantime, hey, it's time to get the ball. We've got this institution. For whatever reason it's going, it becomes, after a while, a little bit unconscious. But you do with it what you will. This is a look at, I'm going to really expand it into this big kind of philosophical sentence, that you get to do as a reader. Is this about this particular experience, and is it about more? Is it about the process of just doing what we call in colleges critical thinking? What is this for? Okay, we'll move on. The next one is Wendell Berry's. And some of the things, I should write these down, the things that you've said, that what we need to do is, you already said this, we need to think. We need to imagine. And I'll let you pick a word from this. This is Wendell Berry.
This one.
And he's just, what he's done when he wrote this, the context for his writing it, he's just read a book full of pictures about the Russians in Soviet Union. And he saw, here it is up there after looking at some pictures in the magazine. You lean at ease in your warm house at night after supper, listening to your daughter play the accordion. You smile with the pleasure of a man confident in his hands, resting after a day of long labor in the forest, the cry of the saw in your head and the vision of coming home to rest. Your daughter's face is clear in the joy of hearing her own music, her fingers live on the keys like people familiar with the land they were born in. You sit at the dinner table late into the night with your son, tying the bright flies that will lead you along the forest streams. Over you, as your hands work, is the dream of the still pools. Over you is the dream of your silence while the east brightens, birds waking close by you in the trees. I have thought of you stepping out of your doorway at dawn, your son in your tracks. You go in under the overarching green branches of the forest, whose ways, strange to me, are well known to you as the sound of your own voice or the silence that lies around you now that you have ceased to speak. And soon, the voice of the stream rises ahead of you, and you take the path beside it. I have thought of the sun breaking pale through the mists over you as you come to the pool where you will fish, and of the mist drifting over the water, and of the cast fly resting light on the face of the pool. And I am here in Kentucky, in the place I have made myself in the world. I sit on my porch above the river that flows muddy and slow along the feet of the trees. I hear the voices of the wren and the yellow-throated warbler whose songs pass near the windows and over the roof. In my house, my daughter learns the womanhood of her mother. My son is at play, pretending to be the man he believes I am. I am the outbreathing of this ground. My words are its words, as the wren's song is its song. Who has invented our enmity? Who has prescribed us hatred of each other? Who has armed us against each other with the death of the world? Who has appointed me such an anger that I should desire the burning of your house or the destruction of your children? Who has appointed such angry to you? Who has set loose the thought that we should oppose each other with the ruin of forests and rivers and the silence of birds? Who has said to us that the voices of my land shall be strange to you and the voices of your land strange to me? Who has imagined that I would destroy myself in order to destroy you, or that I could improve myself by destroying you? Who has imagined that your death could be negligible to me now that I've seen these pictures of your face? Who has imagined that I would not speak familiarly with you, or laugh with you, or visit in your house and go to work with you in the forest? And now one of the ideas of my place will be that you would gladly talk and visit and work with me. I sit in the shade of the trees of the land I was born in. As they are native, I am native. And I hold to this place as carefully as they hold to it. I do not see the national flag flying from the staff of the sycamore, or any decree of the government written on the leaves of the walnut. Nor has the elm bowed before monuments or sworn the oath of allegiance. They have not declared to whom they stand in welcome. In the thought of you, I imagine myself free of the weapons and the official hates that I have borne on my back like a hump. And in the thought of myself, I imagine you free of weapons and official hates, so that if we should meet, we would not go by each other looking at the ground like slaves sullen under their burdens, but would stand clear in the gaze of each other. There is no government so worthy as your son who fishes with you in silence besides the forest pool. There is no national glory so calmly as your daughter, whose hands have learned the music and go their own way on the keys. There is no national glory so comely as my daughter, who dances and sings and is the brightness of my house. There is no government so worthy as my son, who laughs as he comes up the path from the river in the evening for joy. You come too, huh? Anybody?
Well, I just love that. And I have so often thought, when I read something or hear something in the news, who decides all that? That's not how I feel. We're all just people wanting to be loved and care about one another. And this is a beautiful, beautifully written.
Yeah, it is. And so I've added the word, and you said it. We question.
Who decides?
Who decides that for us?
Who we hate, how we feel.
I ask myself that question. This is relevant to this, to change. I was done with a master's degree in English. Done. BA a bachelor's degree with a double major in history and English, and a lot of American history, a lot of American literature, and a master's degree in literature. And a teacher in grad school, as I'm starting on my PhD, asked the question about Richard Wright. He's a black author, if you don't know. And I turned to my friend, the guy I'd been playing basketball with every day after school, after classes. He is black, and I said, "Who's Richard Wright?" And he said, "Well, you know, I wouldn't know either. I've gone through the same school you have, but my parents are educated, and they insisted that I read black literature." And I asked him then, "Who decided for me that I should read, I'm more simplifying, the dead white guys only, and that I shouldn't read?" No one sat there and said, "Make sure they don't read Richard Wright, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, Nikki Giovanni, whatever. Just, these are the guys, typically, right, that you should read." Who decided that? So we're asked in this, and when we come to it, says Maya Angelou, we have this responsibility. When we come to it, to think, to imagine, and now we've got to question, flip it over. This one isn't on the other side. This is on the back of that mending wall, I think. Dover Beach. Is it that where it is?
Yes.
I want to put another word up here. Chaos. A lot of the great pieces of literature, the Aeneid, the Iliad, the Odyssey, are about, and even the creation story, bringing order to chaos. In fact, that's how Genesis starts, isn't it? In the beginning, there's a void, there's chaos, depends on the translation, and God brings order. I've written the sentries down here, not because, well, they're going to be on the test. this covers decades, centuries, really millennia. This is the human experience. And Matthew Arnold is in the midst of all of this Darwinism stuff. He's writing 1822, 1888. Darwin writes his two big books, Shocks to the Earth, in, well, I think, 1854, and again in 1872. And what do you mean? We can't... But Arnold is standing apparently looking out the window, and he sees this natural world, and you'll see what, and pebbles wash up with the waves, and he wonders what's happened to, in the face of chaos, we've already had this word, and we're going to get another one, what happens to faith when it gets challenged by soul? So here we go. The sea is calm tonight, the tide is full, the moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. That's been there for how long? You get it. And he's come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound of thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like folds of a bright girdle furled. Faith, I'll take the Bible as its word, and then there's the Darwinism. Okay, but now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges, drear and naked shingles at shores. Naked singles of the world. What's the hope? What's the change in this? How long has, you know, pebbles been washing on the shore, and now the sea of faith is withdrawing. But he has a final response. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world, which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here, is on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. We are here. Back to Maya Angelou, when we come to it. So another word, you tell me, a word, what is his, is it a resolution, is it a challenge? What does he do with faith drifting? Has he lost it? Or we? Holden at its best, I think he was at Holden when he wrote this. Community? Our summer theme, unity. And then,
is perhaps the poet saying to us that we have to consider this? We can't pass it off if we're going to be true to whatever we are.
Yeah, I'm going to write that word up. In today's world, I don't want to get politics, but the biggest attack is on truth. I've told students for years about literary analysis and about what writing is. Look closely, tell the truth. And this is happening. We've got Darwin to deal with. What do we do?
I think maybe truth means a little bit
different
way here.
Just a little bit longer.
Oh, the truth being used in a little bit different way here. When you're true to someone else, I think you're saying that what matters here is that we're true, we're loyal, we belong to one another. You know, not maybe the, you know, it's not like the truth about, you know, honesty necessarily. I mean, it has a different slant to it, that's all.
Okay, we got one, we said that, and now we've got true to
reality.
To a person, you're saying? True to each other?
Yeah.
I think the way to analyze any poem, as people say, well, what does it mean this? Does it mean this? Does it mean this? You just put it in the context, and it's a beautiful context, and you're right. I just flashed in my brain. There's a wonderful story by J.D. Salinger where this little boy, he's had his heart broken, and he runs away from home, but he doesn't go very far because he's only 3 years old. So he goes down and sits in a boat tied to the dock, and he won't let anybody come in. His mother comes down to him, and this beautiful story does this terrific job of parenting. And finally, why are you running away? I won't tell you. I'm going to come down. No, you can't come in my boat. I'm actually talking about this story on Friday. You can't come in the boat. Why not? You go talk to the other old people. And she finally gets it out of him. And he's Jewish. And he heard somebody say, Sandy said, Papa, Daddy was a big sloppy kike. He's Jewish, and that's the racial slur, of course. And his mother is Jewish, and as she puts her arms around him, the line is, she shivered a little bit, and then patted him on the back of his butt and said, that's not so bad. Do you know what a kike is, honey? Yes, it's one of those things that flies in the air and you hold it with a string. And what we get out of that is that he doesn't even know what it means, but he felt the spiritual vulgarity of it. And I'm talking about criticism and analysis of a story. And so she puts her hand inside this three-year-old's pants, pats him on the butt and says, I got an idea. Let's find Daddy. I got some pickles and we'll race up to the house. And they do. And I read a piece of literary criticism that said, the sexual context between the mother and the boy when she puts her hand in his pants, and I threw that piece of criticism away, I'll tell you. My point is only, in the context of everything that's there, is Ricky right? Dead right. And so we have freedom to move about through a poem that's bigger than our own minds are, which is why they're worth talking about. I just say that's our process of criticism. Okay, after Dover Beach, this long one, and we can do it, because I'm going to skip some. I once saw a play that was kind of rewritten in the modern way, a Shakespeare play, and I remember thinking, who rewrites Shakespeare? Who has that right? Well, I'm going to do it to Wordsworth. This is a story, on one level, about the loss of innocence. Wordsworth, in the plot of the writing of the poem, has been gone from this wooded spot. It's the Tintern. It's an old abbey that is, I have a picture of it. It's, the interns are all gone. It's probably 1,000 years old, and all you see is the walls and a couple of frameworks around windows that have, you know, there are no windows left. But the grass is growing through it, and he's just there remembering time passes. And I remember when I was a little boy here, and I'm not anymore. And the reason I picked this, and it's long, I thought, it's too long, I shouldn't do it. But then I thought, you know, I know a lot of the people at Holden are kind of my age, and we go through this, we go through what Wordsworth was going through. So here it is. And we're not going to read the whole thing, we're going to skip about. And shame on me for doing that to Wordsworth, but I think we'll get the sense of it, and then if you love it, you can keep it, and we'll go. He, too, is responding to the, in his case, I think, the Industrial Revolution. That we've industrialized, we're losing touch with nature, so he goes back. 5 years have passed, 5 summers with the length of 5 long winters, and again I hear these waters rolling from their mountain springs with a soft inland murmur. Once again do I behold these steep and lofty cliffs, then on a wild, secluded scene impress thoughts of more deep seclusion and connect the landscape with the quiet of the sky. I'm just going to ask you, feeling? Nothing, please. Intellectual. The feeling is what?
You're at Holden Village.
I love it. We'll keep going. And you're at Holden Village and you haven't been there for 5 years.
That's what it sounds like.
And it's different now. Okay, well, we'll keep going. Now we're going to skip down to line 14. Once again, I see these hedgerows. Hardy hedgerows. Little lines of sportive wood run wild. These pastoral farms, green to the very door, and wreaths of smoke sent up in silence from among the trees. With some uncertain notice, as might seem of vagrant dwellers in the houseless woods, he's just imagining, whose houses are these? Or of some hermit's cave, where by his fire the hermit sits alone. But here we're going to, I'm going to slow down. These beauteous forms, through a long absence, have not been to me as is a landscape to a blind man's eye. Does he remember them? These beauteous forms, and I'll ask you, readers, go back to that special place that you played when you were 5, when you were 6, when you were 20. These beauteous forms, through a long absence, have not been to me as is a landscape to a blind man's eye. But oft in lonely rooms amid the din of towns and cities, I have owed to them in hours of weariness sensations sweet. What's that about? Bingo. See, you guys don't need me. We can remember goodness. We can remember, what's his word way up there? Beauteous.
You know, it feels a little more than that. It's like he's putting himself back there.
I love it. He is. He's there. And watch how you'll be reinforced with that sense of it. He loves his memories that says, I'm going to read that part again. I have owed to them in hours of weariness sensations sweet, felt in the blood and felt along the heart and passing even into my purer mind with tranquil restoration. Feelings, too, of unremembered pleasure, such perhaps as have no slight or trivial influence on that best portion of a good man's life, his little nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. I I reread that again today, and I thought my freshman year, thought of this incident, my freshman year in college, I was a good football player in high school, and I went to college, and the coach didn't even know my name. He'd look at the tape on my helmet and say, "Olsen, get in there." And then one day, I mean, I was nobody. In fact, a guy who would never skip practice in high school, who would work out with, we didn't have weights in those days, who would just really train out a season and was so dedicated. And I can remember skipping practice one day, looking out the window and say, "There's a football team." Because I didn't matter. Then I went back to practice, you know, I just spent one day. And the captain of the team came walking by while I was a quarterback. I was throwing passes, and he said, "You have a good arm." I'm sure he never remembers that. I lived on that statement for 4 years. Because that was one of those little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Nor less, I trust, to them I may have owed another gift of aspect more sublime, that blessed mood in which the burthen of the mystery, in which the heavy and the weary weight of all this unintelligible world is lightened. My heart aches. I think I'll walk to 10 Mile Falls. I think I'll go swing on the bench. I think I'll go out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. You come too. Skip down to line 64. You've already said this, these lines above they're beautiful, and shame on me for skipping them, but he's had more memory, and then here on 64, "And so I dare to hope, though changed, no doubt, from what I was when first I came among these hills, when like a roe is a deer, when like a roe I bounded over the mountains, by the sides of the deep rivers and the lonely streams, wherever nature led, more like a man flying from something than he dreads, than one who sought the thing he loved. For nature then, the coarser pleasures of my boyish days, and their glad animal movements," "the glad animal movements all gone by, to me, was all in all. I cannot paint what then I was." Turn the page. That's his youth. In the third line down, we have the same pages, "That time is past."
Yeah.
Well, here we go. Anybody over 60? "That time is past." My own metaphor is, I don't run anymore, so you pick up a bike. "That time is past, and all its aching joys are now no more, and all its dizzy raptures. Not for this faint I, nor mourn, nor murmur. Other gifts have followed. For such loss, I would believe abundant recompense." Recompense means?
Repayment.
I think I deal with that line daily as a recently retired person. "Not for this faint I, nor mourn, nor murmur. Other gifts have followed. And for such loss, I would believe abundant recompense." Grandparents, you miss those days raising your kids? Does it help to have grandkids around? Is that abundant recompense or what? "For I have learned," but he talks about nature. "For I have learned to look on nature not as in the hour of thoughtless youth." What was he then? Let's run. Let's play. Let's play in the rocks. Let's dangle our feet. Whatever, you run like a roe. "I have learned not to look on nature, to look on nature not as in the hour of thoughtless youth, but hearing oftentimes the still, sad music of humanity, not harsh nor grating, though of ample power to chasten and subdue." There's been sadness. "And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused." When you're a little boy, a little girl, you look at the tree and you want the flower and you want to pick it and take it home. but an elevated thought, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused than you say, no, the flower's got to stay. And where in it, now he's in his heart and he's in his mind, and I'll back up with that. I felt this joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air and the blue sky and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. The theme of unity. This is a nature lover. Therefore, am I still a lover of the meadows and the woods and mountains, and of all that we behold from this green earth, of all the mighty world of eye and ear, both what they half create and what perceive. Turn the page. So we've got memory. We've got this belief of abundant recompense. But he also has his best friend with him. It's his sister. There's no strange relationship. Brother, sister, and they love each other. And they're companions. For thou art with me here upon the banks of this fair river. Thou, my dearest friend, my dear, dear friend, and in thy voice I catch the language of my former heart and read my former pleasures in the shooting lights of thy wild eyes. Oh, yet a little while may I behold in thee what I was once, my dear, dear sister, and this prayer I make, knowing that nature never did betray the heart that loved her. I'm going to keep going, but I'm going to give another word up here. He's okay alone in these woods, but it's enriched, enhanced with this dear, dear friend. Line 136. It starts to blow against the end. I'm going to start with, in after years, when these wild ecstasies shall be matured into a sober pleasure, when thy mind shall be a mansion for all lovely forms, thy memory be as a dwelling place for all sweet sounds and harmonies, oh then, if solitude or fear or pain or grief should be thy portion, with what healing thoughts of tender joy will thou remember me and these my exhortations? Nor, perchance, if I should be where I no more can hear thy voice nor catch from thy wild eyes these gleams of past existence. I love this line. Wilt thou then forget that on the banks of this delightful stream we stood together? And that I, so long a worshiper of nature, hither came, unwearied in that service, rather say with warmer love, oh, with far deeper zeal of holier love. Nor wilt thou then forget that after many wanderings, many years of absence, these steep woods and lofty cliffs and this green pastoral landscape were to me more dear, both for themselves and for thy sake. That is the heart.
It gives me a sense that the present is trying to push up the memory.
The what?
The present, the now, is trying to press out, say that the memory is not significant, trying to claim
it. I love that. Memory isn't just the past for him. It's now. And then what's in this brain, this love for nature that he had then, it's even richer now, but it's now, and you just said it better than I just did. Others. How about this? We survive in the exact relationship to the dedication of our poets. I don't think it's physical survival she's talking about. It's spiritual survival. There's all these things that you guys said, faith, and thinking, and imagining, and questioning, and hoping, and community, and love, and memory in the present. Wordsworth has another poem that I didn't hand out because his time is perfect. The story of the poem is, the title of it is Michael. It's very long and magnificent. Michael and Luke is his father, every year worked together on the farm. This is Industrial Revolution time. There are no tractors. They're out there with their hands putting up the stones to make the fences. They're out there with the hoes and the rakes and the plows and the horses. And there's one beautiful line early on that they go on each side of this, not unlike in the mending wall, and together they pick up the stones and replace and rebuild the fence to keep the cows in the fence and so on. And they do that. And Luke decides, Luke's the father. Michael decides, I want to go to town. The industry is working, the city life is what I want, and this is the kind of the metaphor for the Industrial Revolution that separates this the farmer from the factory, okay, to oversimplify. And they say, well, we'll keep the light on for you. They owned a Motel 6. but Michael never comes back. And the line that then follows the one about the two of them, it says this, and thither he went, and never again picked up a single stone. But because Wordsworth is Wordsworth, and memory can reignite, the love for the son didn't change, and the son's love for his father probably didn't change. We don't know, he doesn't come back. But Wordsworth has these beautiful lines, and I leave them with you. There's a comfort in the strength of love. 'Twill make a thing endurable, else which would overset the brain or break the heart. That's a Wordsworth, too. Thank you for being here.